This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
Hi, I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. Millions of people rely on our protein bars and hydration mixes to win their day. Turns out Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, is one of them. We've teamed up with Chef Keller to craft a bar and hydration mix that marry world-class flavor with exceptional nutrition. Our special edition salted caramel chip bar delivers all the decadence of a fine dining dessert plus protein minus sugar and carbs. And our zero sugar yuzu mango hydration mix packs an authentic citrusy punch and a mental boost from lion's mane and magnesium. The best part? 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Total no-brainer.
Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
This episode of Desert Island Dishes is brought to you by Lloyds Bank. With their Club Lloyds current account, you can now get 12 months of Disney Plus as your lifestyle benefit. To know me is to know that I love watching things on TV, so I am so excited to tell you about this. You might think that Disney Plus is just for Disney films. And yes, it's great for all of them. We must have watched Disney's Frozen at least 100 times by now. But it's so much more than that. With Disney Plus, there is endless entertainment with exclusive originals, brand new series, blockbuster movies, and it's just one of the great benefits that you can now get with a Club Lloyds account. I highly recommend watching The Bear if you haven't seen it yet. It's all about a talented chef who's presented with the challenge of overhauling his family sandwich shop. Season 2 is coming soon and I can't wait. Lloyds Bank are taking care of not only your banking needs, but entertainment too. Visit lloydsbank.com/clublloyds to find out more. £3 monthly fee is charged to maintain the Club Lloyds account, but waived each month that you pay in £2,000 or more. UK residents 18 and over, Disney Plus subscription required. Terms and conditions apply. Thank you very much to Lloyds Bank. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, I hope you're all very well. Can you even believe we're in August? The rain is coming down almost like a monsoon as I write this. And I don't know about you, but I am holding out for a very hot September. I love sitting down with today's guest and hearing his thoughts on the food that means the most to him. Particularly interesting, of course, because his job is that of a food critic. So when it's your job to critique food, how do you then tally that with what you know food means to you and the food that you love the most and what you eat the most often? Also really interesting discussing food and culture and how tied up that is with our identity. Also really, really loved the story behind the best dish he's ever eaten. Very funny, definitely really relatable. Anyway, it was all really interesting and I loved meeting Jimmy and I hope you'll enjoy it too. Thank you to Lloyds Bank for helping us to bring this to you each week. Whether you're walking to work, cooking in the kitchen, on a dog walk. I love getting the messages that you send me, by the way, about where you listen to the podcast. Everyone seems to have their own ritual. And honestly, I love it so much that Desert Island Dishes is a part of your weekly routine. Thank you. My guest today is Jimmy Famurewa. Jimmy is a writer, broadcaster, and food critic. He is the chief restaurant critic for the Evening Standard, a regular guest judge on the BBC One series MasterChef, and was also one of the judges on Channel 4's The Great Cookbook Challenge with Jamie Oliver. In 2021, he won Restaurant Writer of the Year at both the Fortnum & Mason Awards and also the Guild of Food Writers Awards. And as an interviewer, he's profiled Black African Londoners, including Idris Elba, John Boyega, and Skepta. He says the thing he loves most about writing about food is wordless communication. It's a way to be creative, clever, or reference culture without speaking. I love being a conduit for that, trying to find the words so people can share the experience and almost taste the food. And when you read his work, this is nothing but the truth with the way he has with words and transporting you to the setting about which he's writing, despite being on the tube or sitting on your sofa. His book, Settlers, was released last year and is described as a journey into the extraordinary, vibrant world of Black African London, which is shaping modern Britain and truly what makes a Londoner. Welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you very much. Yeah, always nice to get such a lovely intro and, you know, a challenge to try and keep a straight face and not. And it's always, I don't know if this is true of a lot of writers, but like when people start quoting things you've written back to you, you're like, did I say that? Like, I think maybe because you like churn through such a volume of written words that you're like, oh, wow, that sounds quite good.
I guess that's also it must feel quite different hearing your words through someone else's voice, like very different to when you're writing it and it's in your own head.
Yeah.
So, Jimmy, at the end of this episode, we're going to cast you off to a desert island. How does the thought of being alone on a desert island make you feel?
Well, as the parent of young children, sounds amazing, to be honest. I think I'm sure that I would obviously really miss my family and miss all the people that I love. But yeah, there'd probably be an initial wave of like, oh my God, I'm just going to like reacquaint myself with napping and sitting silently. And, you know, obviously anything that I've been able to smuggle to the island as well. So yeah, there's mixed emotions, let's say that.
That quote in the introduction is one of the most beautiful things I've read about food. It's a wordless communication and a way to be creative, clever, or reference a culture without speaking. You say you see yourself as a conduit for enabling people to taste the food without actually eating it. You are, of course, a brilliant writer and a brilliant eater, but how about cooking? Are you a good cook?
I love cooking and I would say that I'm a decent cook. I think what can maybe be misconstrued when you write about food for a living, when you're a restaurant critic, there's a kind of like, oh, could you do any better? That you are essentially this kind of backseat driver that's forever implying how you would have changed it or done it better. I think when you're around the people that cook at that high level and under real pressure and the contestants on shows like MasterChef, you realise that that is like a special breed, that there's like a rigour and a sort of a skill that most home cooks just do not have. And so I wouldn't put myself in the bracket of I could go on MasterChef. But I think actually I'm obviously interested in food. I cook a lot. I'm interested in tasting something. When I'm writing about a restaurant and visiting a place and trying to recreate it at home, like there's a real connection between the two for me. And so I think I'm quite sort of messy, maybe, and quite there's a bit of chaos in there and it's quite kind of free form. And I'm not really sort of somebody that is scared to go off-piste and defy a recipe. If I think I know better, shockingly. But yeah, I would say I'm a pretty good cook, actually. I think if you polled people in my life and around me, they'd hopefully be quite kind.
Well, funny you should say that, Jimmy, because actually I've got a poll here.
Imagine if you had. Yeah, and they were like, don't know what he's talking about. He's terrible.
He's terrible. So I know your mother was a fantastic cook. So let's dive straight into the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Yeah, I'm always talking about my mum in relation to food. And I sometimes feel a bit like, oh God, I need to like stop talking about my mum constantly. But there's no getting away from it. She's so central to my understanding and appreciation for food. She's a naturally gifted, like really innate cook. And yeah, I mean, the dish that really evokes my childhood, it's really humble and really simple and possibly slightly weird, but it's stew, like a red like tomato and pepper stew, which is almost like the mother source of like Nigerian cooking. It's blended peppers, plum tomatoes, scotch bonnet chili in there as well, onion, and you just cook it like right down till it's kind of like sticky, jammy. It kind of almost gets like oily and separates in that way. And it's really rich stew. And sometimes you'll have like slow cooked beef in that, sort of really falling apart. And so we'd normally have some stew like that in the house. And I think when we just wanted something quite quick to eat, we would have that with bread and with there's a specific kind of Nigerian bread that I talk about in Settlers as well, that's called agege bread. And it's quite sweet and soft and almost cake-like. And it's a little bit like a Japanese, sort of...
The milk loaf.
Yeah, milk loaf. Yeah, like shokupan. And you'd get that fresh. And it's something that I think, especially in like black communities, there's a lot of Caribbean bakeries, West African bakeries, and there's a specific kind of repertoire of baked goods. And so, you know, say something like after church, we'd get like a fresh baked like loaf of that, still warm. And then we'd have thick slices of that, like with stew on the side. Like so simple, so humble, just eating that with your hands, dipping, you know, using the kind of quite squidgy sweet bread to scoop up bits of this really deep, sticky, rich, spicy, umami-laden sauce and, like, scoop that into your mouth is, that is just, like, taste of my childhood in so many ways.
Jimmy, you can tell you're a food writer. I feel like I'm eating that right now and it's
I can't help
amazing.
Myself, can I? Like, it's funny, there are times, like, I was doing an interview recently and they read back, like, a description of some dish that I'd written to me, and I was a bit like, oh my god, wow, like maybe just say tasty next time, mate. Like I was a bit like, I just can't help myself.
In something I read, you said that you asked your mum recently about your childhood and she said that you didn't really love Nigerian food beyond fried rice or jollof rice, and she couldn't cook certain things like stockfish in the house because you'd all complain about the smell. And so it was only relatively recently that you all started appreciating African food. Do you remember how old you were when you really began to appreciate how great it was?
Yeah, well, this is it. My shame as a quite a fussy eater in some ways, really. And kind of, I think like a lot of immigrant kids probably had that thing of not appreciating the amazing kind of like culinary culture that was like right there in your kind of, you know, underneath your nose. Because I think... when you start to explore your immigrant heritage and you talk about it quite a lot and you almost become this kind of de facto spokesperson for it, you can sometimes skip over the fact that, yeah, a lot of people have quite a conflicted relationship with it and it's not something that you instantly love, and these tastes and these preferences like ebb and flow as we get older, don't they? And so, yeah, I'm trying to think when I first started... Like, there were certain things that I always loved, like jollof rice, like that stew that I've described. And I think it was just more that I kind of gravitated towards things that were outside of what my mum would cook. I don't know, like, I it's weird, isn't it? Sometimes you can tell yourself, oh, yeah, I'm not really interested in that. And I definitely grew up being like, oh, like awful and things like that. But I don't know. I think maybe writing about food more as well, like you become more adventurous by dint of being exposed to these things a little bit more. And so, yeah, it probably has been a gradual thing, but it's certainly the last few years, especially where I've really sort of embraced and like grown to like love all aspects of that culture, especially the food.
You touched on that briefly there, so it's the perfect time to talk about the second desert island dish, and that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
Yeah, I really was obsessed with food shows and like a TV chefs, and I would watch them like really obsessively, like things like The Naked Chef were obviously like really pivotal. But two of the things that I really remember cooking first were I made some onion rings at school. And they were slightly disastrous, like the kind of the coating wasn't particularly like all over the onion rings. They were slightly soggy, but I remember being quite proud of them because it was like, oh, wow, like onion rings are something you can make. And I remember kind of taking them home in a little kind of Tupperware thing as they were just getting less and less desirable. But I remember feeling like a note of pride. And then one of the first times, and it's barely a recipe, but that I remember having the wherewithal to like see something and follow it, was Jamie Oliver did this dish, and it's hardly even a recipe, but it's a fry up in a pan, and you crack eggs into like the gaps and you do it all in one pan. And so the eggs kind of form it into this kind of frisbee type thing that you then kind of lever out onto a plate. And even though it wasn't really a recipe, I remember a bit of a light bulb moment in cooking that, because it was because it introduced you to the significance of cooking times, and it was about putting things in a certain order, and you put the sausages in first, and you put, you know, the tomatoes in if you're going to add them, and you put the mushrooms. And I think because there was something a little bit like, you know, it's like something you'd see in the Beano or like the, or the Dandy maybe. And I really remember that becoming part of my repertoire and then being like a bridge to thinking about, to feeling a degree of, oh, okay, I know the order to put things in, and now I can sort of, oh, I can add some mushrooms to that. It was a route to kind of wanting to try out more things as well. So yeah, the onion rings and the frisbee fry up.
But I think a fry up, it's not actually as simple as it seems. It's a bit like the Sunday lunch where it is all about timing.
Yeah,
but
if
that's something that you learn early on and you master the timings, it can give you so much confidence.
Yeah.
Which, as we know, that's what learning to cook is all about.
No, definitely. There was real confidence.
Jimmy, you're probably most famous for being a restaurant writer, but you are also a journalist who writes about a very broad range of topics. Was journalism what you always wanted to do growing up?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to write from like a really early age, and I really loved like writing stories and like showed like, I think, like a sort of aptitude for it from quite an early age. But I just don't know if I really realized that journalism could be like a, you know, a specific avenue for that. Like I think when you grow up in a world where you don't know anyone that's a journalist, like I didn't really put it together that there are people responsible for those words that you're seeing, you know, in a newspaper or in a magazine at that time. Like it seemed like to be happening in this far off kind of mysterious world. And so I think from the moment that I kind of connected the dots and realized, oh, okay, there's these jobs and there's journalism, and that is a route to kind of storytelling in many ways, and that was probably around the time that I was at university. And then from then really there's not really been any other career, and I don't really know if there was ever like an alternative, to be honest, which is kind of terrifying. I was very into I did theatre, and I did an English and drama degree, and so I was really into like performing in plays and stuff at school. We took one up to like the Edinburgh Festival, like when we were at sixth form, and so I was really quite into that. A lot of people around me were like, "Oh, you should like pursue acting," but I never knew if I really believed it as a viable like option. But that was probably the only other thing that I was like really into, and so it is quite interesting now to have entered into the world of TV and broadcasting as a writer, but then to feel yourself in those situations that I almost recognize as like performance situations and like being able to improvise and being comfortable in those scenarios. Like I do feel like it's quite strange that was something that I was really into left, and now it's kind of like almost come back around in a strange way.
In a completely different way.
Yeah.
Having had the experiences that you've had, do you think that is an avenue that if you had another go at life, would you have wanted to pursue that?
Maybe it was that kind of slight, you know, child of immigrants cliche where I was like, I'm never going to get acting past my mum as a viable career, so I need to like edge towards something more respectable. But I think that is changing. You only need to look at the sort of varied generation of, you know, British actors that come from different backgrounds and have different cultural heritage, and particularly like those from like the broad African diaspora. I'd see that's probably shifting, and maybe there is part of me that in another lifetime would have liked to, but I don't know really. The more I think about it, the more I think I've got a pretty good gig in there. You know, I
like in the space of this one sentence you've gone there.
I know
you've had a good time as an actor and then I
thought about it, and I was like, I really thought about it, and I was like, do you know what? Now I've got a pretty good gig, like, in terms of...
You even tried to blame it on your mum there, Jimmy.
I did try to palm it off on her, but yeah, I'm sure she'd be, like, really up for it. She was, like, very encouraging.
You've said that when you were starting out in journalism, most people were generalists, and they didn't pick a specialist topic.
Yeah.
And when you started, you leant more towards culture and the arts writing, but food was always in the mix, and it really came to the fore as you progressed. What was it about food writing that really drew you in?
I started out on magazines and particularly lifestyle magazines, there was really this feeling that you had to be sort of expert at a number of things and like interested in a number of things. You'd be sort of given a story and you'd be like, yeah, here we go. But then I entered like working for the Evening Standard and working for a newspaper, and it's a lot more. You have your beat, you have your kind of specialism, and that's your patch, and you kind of don't really deviate from that too much. And so I've always liked writing about other things as well as food, even as food has come to the fore. I always talk about this, but when I wrote my first kind of guest column for the ES magazine, the Evening Standard's weekly supplement, before becoming restaurant critic there, like I did like a guest column, and I just had such a clear sense of how I wanted to approach it. I think I'd read a lot of restaurant reviews. I was a fan of them. Seemed like this amazing vehicle for all sorts of different kind of interesting like avenues regarding like changing cities and food culture and different parts of town, and kind of like it just seemed like, and you know, social observations and a way to be like funny but also be insightful and serious. And so I kind of like the challenge of trying to kind of do justice to the broader context and the bigger picture and be an interested observer in that way, and also give you an entertaining, hopefully quite funny, evocative sense of what it's actually like to sit at a table there, to eat their signature dish, to kind of have a cocktail in hand kind of thing. So it's always a challenge, but I feel like it's a strange thing that crystallizes so many of my interests and passions and puts them in this really, hopefully, quite appealing package.
Yeah. No, it's about so much more than just the food.
Yeah. I think that's what you do so well. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I guess it's one of those things that I've almost stumbled into, but it just feels absolutely right. And just chimes with so many of my kind of longstanding interests.
That's often how you know you're doing the right thing. And yeah, it just feels like everything's clicked into place.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Jimmy, we're on to the third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
Oh, wow, this is such a tough question. Genuinely, because I think so much of this is like linked to context, isn't it? Like your specific moment of like need or like hunger or what just happened. Or I think of, and my wife probably won't thank me for this, after our eldest had been born, it was one of those hospitals where they sort of kicked the other partner out, or like the dad out in this case, and you weren't allowed to sleep there. And I did not put up much of a fight because I was so tired.
No.
I was like, oh no, what, we can't, yeah. Oh, anyway, I'm gone. And I remember going to get a kebab. I remember going. And it probably wasn't even that great a kebab. It was kind of delirious happiness and relief and all of those things that you probably feel in the aftermath of like a child being born, or like a big sort of scenario like that. And I remember just eating it in this exhausted state, and then obviously going straight back to, you know, like as early as I could the next morning to help out. And I was maybe going to go for something else, but I remember vividly that the joy that I felt while eating it was really related to, like, yeah, it was relief, really, that, like, you know, everyone was going to be all right. My wife had, you know, our first kid, and just feeling that sense of, like, oh, my God, here we go.
Yeah. That's such a vivid description, and that's such a strange time when everything has changed. Like, you suddenly have a child, but they're still in the hospital, and you're not yet into your normal life.
Yeah.
In late 2020, after almost 48 years in the role, Faye Mashler stepped down as the Evening Standard's chief restaurant critic, and you took over. The position is seen as being one of the most influential on Londoners' dining habits. And as Mashler had been in the job for just shy of half a century, this was a very big deal. Did you feel intimidated?
Yeah, it was a big deal, and it was pretty daunting. Like, Faye was and still is such a sort of titanic figure within the the realm of like restaurant writing and food writing. It was particularly strange because when I worked at the Evening Standard, when I was in-house on the paper, I would edit the food section. And so I would kind of be tasked with the receiving phase copy and putting it on the page and putting a headline on it. So I was kind of like a point person. And so I was kind of on the other side of it. And so it was really strange to suddenly find myself in that role. And that was probably like quite crucially one of the times when I just got more of an appreciation for the rhythms of trends and openings. Like that was another little step jump in terms of like getting to know the world a little bit more. Taking over from Faye was very daunting, but it was really exciting. And it was something that I like really embraced. And Faye was so kind of kind about me taking over and so kind of like supportive. And I think I wrote at the time, it was her rigor and her curiosity and her talent, which again, I must point out, she's still demonstrating because she's still writing fantastic restaurant columns. And it was that I just really wanted to make sure like I emulated, but also that I did in my own way. And yeah, so the other thing that I would say, the flip side of that feeling of being somewhat daunted and respectful of what Faye had done and what I was kind of taking on board, I was really conscious, perhaps not initially, but certainly, you know, as I continued in the role, that I just needed to do it as myself.
You can't pretend to be a restaurant critic based on people that you've read before. You
can really do exactly. But I'm always thinking, it needs to feel like me. It needs to be like my kind of response to it. It needs to sound like me. It needs to kind of be my kind of take on it. If there's a reference that's quite sort of arcane and like obscure, but I feel like it's justified, because I always felt like the thing that I really loved about reading restaurant reviews or criticism or writing of all kinds really was that there was such specificity to it. But I have really enjoyed the challenge of kind of hopefully doing justice to it in my own way.
Mm, that's so interesting to hear you talk about that, and definitely some really good life lessons in there.
Yeah, hopefully.
Let's talk about the fourth Desert Island dish. What is your favourite sandwich?
Now we're talking. So I weirdly, I don't know what's happened, but I don't eat that many sandwiches anymore. But I really love, and this is, a lot of people have this in hotels and traveling and stuff, but a club sandwich.
Ooh, yeah.
Oh my God. Like there's a particular thrill and pleasure to like an unbelievably good, like room service club sandwich.
So good.
And sort of as almost connected to that, I did put it between bread recently, but sometimes I'll just have it as like a salad. But if you like roast a chicken and you've got like leftover kind of meat from like the carcass, to sort of then get some really good mayonnaise, like a lot of mustard, and then sort of make a kind of chicken mayo, like loads of pepper. And like, there's nothing better than like a really good, like homemade sort of chicken mayo. Between some good bread. I got quite into making flatbreads, like kind of piadina style like ones for a while. And I did one of those. Me and my wife actually were taking the kids to Legoland. And I don't know if any parents have ever been to Legoland, but oh my goodness.
Got to get that driving
license. Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, yeah. And we were ready for the fact that the food options there would not be that great. And I had some leftover flatbread dough. And so I made flatbread with like, you know, some, I think there was some like sort of dressed like little gem in there, like really good chicken salad. And we had those like in the car on the way there, and that was absolute magic. Yeah. Club sandwich, but yeah, the chicken salad part of it is increasingly important.
Yeah, so good. I came across a quote where you said that restaurants are stories in themselves. And I love that special moment of discovery when I've had a fantastic meal, experienced something I'd never seen before, I'm inspired by something completely unfamiliar. The food disarms people in a really lovely way. Does that mean the way to your heart is through innovation and exciting things? Or can a restaurant wow you with the familiar? Or does simple just not really cut it for you?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess it's all relative in terms of like what will be familiar to you and what will be unfamiliar. I guess what I was kind of maybe driving at with that quote is, I will inevitably end up on these real rabbit holes of types of restaurant or types of cuisine that are like expressions of a particular culture or like a particular time. Like I did one recently that was about these, I forget the Cantonese name of them now, but they're essentially Hong Kong's version of the Greasy Spoon Cafe. Mm. And they kind of were popularized in the 1950s, and they were kind of a way to almost emulate what was being eaten by the British expat community. But then they became and are increasingly really popular with the Cantonese community. They do like borscht soup because there was like, you know, a Russian community there, and they do like, you know, milky teas, and it's kind of, you know, really beautifully brewed oolong and things like that. And so it's this kind of weird genre mashing thing, such a rich story and culture, and like I love things like that. And so I think the answer is authenticity, really. And I love places that really transport you and introduce you to something that, whether it's new to you or not, it feels really detailed and textured and soulful. Those are really the places that I kind of respond to.
We're on to the fifth desert island dish. Jimmy, what's the dish you eat the most often?
Oh, this is a tricky one, but I think I'm going to go for, and we mentioned it a little bit when we were talking about my childhood, jollof rice. Mm. I probably eat it a lot. And part of that is because my kids, my mum's grandkids, absolutely love it. It's probably the one bit of like Nigerian cuisine that they will kind of really love. And because it's like, you know, got some nutrients in it that aren't like, you know, frozen peas and like ketchup. And we probably are like, oh yeah, we'll get them some jollof. And so I think just by dint of that, you know, my mum will keep us really well stocked with it. Oh. And she'll make it at any hour. And I think because of that, and this is another kind of knock-on effect of the pandemic, I, you know, forcibly, after some lessons from my mum, taught myself to cook it, because, you know, that it was really all the many sort of heartbreaking things about that period and really difficult things. I'm sure so many people had their own version of this, was that in that isolation, you weren't able to have these dishes that you know, you can't cook, or that you don't know how to, or that you can't make in the same way as a friend or a relative.
Which was
that.
Ironic, because those are the dishes that comfort you the most.
Yeah, completely, And so it was really sort of pronounced. And so I think because of that, I've taught myself to make jollof. It is all right. It is always getting better.
So what is your mum's secret?
Oh, God, she makes it in such a specific way. I've had to do that thing of slightly defying her method. I've kind of fused, like, some of her methodology with, like, another recipe, like, that I kind of, like, use that's a little bit more kind of idiot-proof, as it were. jollof rice is probably the thing that I have most frequently, and that's both because I'm cooking it for the people that I love, and also that my mum is still, you know, occasionally there'll be a knock at the door, and I'll open the door and she won't even be there.
Oh.
There'll just be like a pile of, like, you know, like some Tupperware, like with rice in it. And she's already like scurried back to the car to unload, you know, the seven other dishes that she's like cooking and stuff. Like it's incredible. And yeah, at my book events, a big part of the appeal has been that my mum, as people are increasingly learning, will like cook like more than she absolutely needs to. And like she kind of, it started off as she'd just do like puff puff, which are these amazing kind of like drop donuts that we have in Nigeria that you fry in oil and then you toss in like sugar, and they are so good. Oh my goodness.
We need to get your mum her own restaurant.
Yeah, I think
like
so.
Dream.
Yeah, I think the end game is the book just becomes a method for other people to just buy her food. Yeah, the way that I sell books is through offering like a bowl of jollof and some puff puff on the side.
Oh my God, that sounds like a very good scheme to me. So you have a podcast called Where's Home Really, which explores this question with a different guest each week and gets them to answer the question of where home is as told through people, words, places, and food. And it's both fun but also fascinating to hear how people approach the question. And it ties in with the themes of your brilliant book, Settlers, which came out last year. I wondered, Has there been anything that surprised you in how people have chosen to answer the question?
Yeah, it's been an amazing show to do. And as you say, such a kind of spiritual successor slash companion piece to like Settlers, in that Settlers was me exploring my own culture and heritage and how I was raised and how that is affecting and moulding British society at large and British history, really, and Black British history. And this kind of like opens it up to all sorts of people with different kind of cultural background. So yeah, similarly, you know, to this show, in some ways we kind of ask people to come with certain elements, and you know, yeah, be that a person that really evokes home, a phrase that really evokes home, a dish or a plate of food, and a place, and it's really varied. Like, so you know, a lot of people it will be, oh, it's definitely my mum, or it's this kind of like figure. So yeah. I think people like bring so much to it. Andrew Wong, the 2 Michelin starred chef of Chinese heritage, he spoke about his friend's front step as being his place. But one of the things that's really come to the fore is the ways in which people create their own home from and their own sense of it through different cultures kind of coalescing. And I think this is really universal as well. And this is kind of the central driving question and interest of the show. You know, almost by accident, that has become one of the more interesting components of it, where people really dig into how they've created home for themselves.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And it's conversations like that that help everyone to understand not only themselves, but also more about other people in general.
Really, massively. Mm.
Let's move on to the 6th desert island dish, and that's your go-to dinner party dish.
One that springs to mind is something that like friends did for us once, and I really remember it just being so great. And it sounds quite humble and maybe sounds a bit sort of like weeknight, but a really good chili, maybe sort of, you know, you up the steaks and you kind of, you could do it veg, and then you could have, which I've definitely done before, and like, you know, just gone big on some like really kind of nice beans and get some like ancho chilies in there, and, you know, splash out on like proper like Mexican, like, you know, oregano and things like that, and really go for it. Bit of cinnamon, and really sort of cook it slowly and like imbue it with loads of flavour, or, you know, upgrade it a little bit with some like brisket and like proper like slow cooked meat rather than the bog standard mince. And then the real appeal and the real kind of thing that makes it fun for a dinner party, I think, is like bits on the sides. And so like really fresh kind of like zingy salad and like, you know, grated cheese, and make an amazing guacamole and have some, you know, baked potatoes and fresh chilies. But I think fundamentally it is having those multiple elements. It's kind of, those are the best kind of dinner party dishes for me, where there's a bit of everything and it's kind of got that kind of buffet feel, which is obviously labour intensive. But there's something about a chili that I just always really love it. Yeah, I always really love doing
it. I turned up to someone's house for a dinner party and that was on the menu. Yeah. I was so happy. Yeah. Jimmy, on Desert Island Dishes, we've got a cookbook corner. Mm. What is your most treasured cookbook?
Oh, wow. There are so many that I cook from quite a lot. And like, weirdly, there's one that I really, really love. And I think it's often the way that the cookbooks that you've used the most are often like slightly strange ones that are like, came free with like some like appliance or
whatever.
Yeah, it's really weird.
The Magimix book from 1972 is a real banger.
So I'm going to say two. So one would be The Naked Chef. And my mum, very sweetly, like, she wrote in the front of it, like, you know, I think I got it, like, she got it for me, like, yeah, the year it came out. So what was that, like, 2000? And she's written, like, a lovely message and dated it because she's obsessed with doing that. And you're a bit like, why are you doing this? But now it's such a kind of treasured moment and memory. And that was kind of such a big sort of formative book for me. But then also, and again, it came from my mum, there's this one and it's literally called like The Best of British Cookbook. I wish I could shout out the author, but it's really classic British recipes. And I think having grown up with a mum that was a really talented cook and would cook a variety of dishes, but there's a whole family of dishes, things like cauliflower cheese and things that I've grown to love that just there isn't really the crossover within like West African cuisine of those kind of creamy, stodgy, like, you know, those kind of really hearty British dishes. But I often find that I'm looking for how to make some classic dish or something like a toad in the hole or whatever, and it'll always be in there and the recipes will always be like quite useful. And I kind of like the old-fashionedness of it. And it is probably that and The Naked Chef are the most kind of like spattered.
Yeah,
and,
the sign of a very well-loved book.
Big time, yeah, definitely.
Jimmy, we're on to the final seventh desert island dish. What is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
Yeah, so I'd probably have a couple of courses at least. I'd have three courses, let's say. I'd start with, and it's a variation of that stew and agege bread dish that I mentioned earlier, but it would be the stew with yam, which we would eat a lot on Sundays again, and that is kind of, you know, those kind of really gnarled, thick-skinned tubers that you see, but they've got this amazing, if you like, peel them and just steam them quite simply and maybe like have a bit of butter with them, or to be really authentic to my 90s childhood, it'd be like margarine, to be honest. And you have that, you just steam them quite simply, a bit of salt, a bit of sugar as well, and have that with the stew. So I'd start off with a bit of that, and then I would have an amazing cheeseburger. I shouted out the burger from the Plimsoll, which is a pub in Finsbury Park in North London that I kind of reviewed in its early incarnation, a chef duo called Four Legs. So I love that burger, but I'm going to shout out an In-N-Out burger because they're such a rarity, aren't they? They're like only ever on the, it almost goes back to that that club sandwich thing where it's like, you know, if you're ever in the West Coast of America, like I vividly remember actually getting my cab driver on the way to get a flight from, I'd been out to Las Vegas on the set of The Hangover Part 3, weirdly. And I remember getting my cab driver like tentatively being like, we stop at In-N-Out on the way. And he was like, absolutely. Like, you know, he kind of got that it was like a very important thing. And so, yeah, I'd have an In-N-Out burger. And then to finish, what would I have? This could change literally every day, but I'm going to go for a nice creme caramel.
Ooh.
Because I feel like that will just kind of like set me off. And again, the starter is very personal. The middle dish, I love a burger. I've always loved a burger and it feels like it has like a scarcity. And the creme caramel is one of those things that I just don't eat that often. It'll give me happy memories of my former privileged life of you know, eating amazing restaurant food before sitting on my desert island.
Oh, Jimmy, those are your desert island dishes. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
So there we have it. Another delicious day of desert island dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and also I think wherever you're listening, really. It does make a difference because it boosts the show and it helps other people to find it, which is great because it means I can keep bringing it to you each week. If you don't already, then do come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes and you can sign up for the newsletter and find a whole host of different recipes at desertislanddishes.co. Thank you again to our season sponsor, Lloyds Bank, and I will see you next week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.